Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Just for Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Good evening. My name's Preston Washington. I'm your host here in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm a published author, genealogist, and historian.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, this is Keith Henley.
Is this Keith? Keith, my name's Preston Washington. I'm your host tonight. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you tonight?
I'm okay.
Good.
I want our listeners to know that we're listening to the Gist of Freedom. Tonight's guest is Keith Henley, actor, entrepreneur, and graduate of South Carolina State College, where he majored in chemistry and biology, studied at the Camden College in Blackwood, New Jersey, and there you studied theater, is that correct?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry about that.
Okay. And again, Keith Henley is our guest. He's an actor. He's putting on a one-man show in reference to George Washington Carver.
Mm-hmm.
Keith, how did you get interested? What was the motivation to get involved with portraying George Washington Carver?
Well, pretty much I enjoy studying African-American history. And some of the companies that I work for were very instrumental, and they actually hone in on people portraying people of history, and that got me really interested in doing that. George Washington Carver has always been a George Washington Carver, along with Booker T. Washington and several of the other historians of the past, were always moved me. I didn't know that you could actually make a living out of portraying them, which is fascinating. And I think telling their story is even more something that is needed. There are a lot of people, not only of people of color, but people in general who just don't know history. And I would feel though that telling history and then bringing it life, find it makes it more interesting, and people become really interested in once they see someone else portray the life, and that you're able to talk to them one on one, and that's a very interesting aspect, opposed to sitting in a classroom listening to someone quote them or read about them in a book. When you actually get to see a person, it brings a little flair to it, just a little flair to the history.
Where will you be performing this?
I probably won't be performing George Washington Carver until February of next year. But I told Miss Jess that I will be performing Hercules, who was George Washington's master chef, on tomorrow for a group of dietitians. He's another one of the other characters that I portray.
Okay, well, can you give us a bit of an excerpt of Mr. Carver?
Well, it would be an honor. Good evening. It is an honor and a privilege to be invited to your show. Allow me to just give you a brief story about who I am. George Washington Carver. I was born a slave in the year 1864. In Missouri, on the Carver Plantation. My parents, Mary and Giles, although I did not spend much time with him, my father died very early, at a very early age of my life. And then my mother and myself and my sister were kidnapped not too far after the emancipation, and my mother and sister were sold off. I, in turn, was found by Master Carver's friend, Mr. Bentley, who was able to bring me back to the plantation where I was raised with my brother, James, who was... he and I were taken care well taken care of by our master. Master Carver and his wife were very instrumental in making sure that my brother and I had a good education. And they encouraged us to further our educational endeavors. It was around about 18 years old when I actually was able to leave and to go to high school. No sooner after I was away, my brother James had passed on. Although I was sent away in Missouri, I was able to finish high school, and then I went to Iowa State. There I was the first black to attend Iowa State. Not soon after I graduated from Iowa State, they had asked me to remain and to become a part of their faculty, the first black on the faculty of Iowa State. The dean there also encouraged me to get my master's degree in agriculture, and I studied. And the word of my accomplishments had reached out to Booker T. Washington, the founder of the Tuskegee Institute. And it was there around 1896 that he wrote a letter and asked me if I would be interested in coming to Tuskegee to help the black farmers there. They were having problems with their crops. The cotton was destroying the land, and the boll weevils were overcoming the land, and they were in need of someone of my caliber to come in to help them. He didn't offer me much. He didn't have much money. He didn't have a place for me to stay. But it was at that moment that I sat and I prayed with the Lord, and I asked him, what can I do? What should I do? And I moved on to Tuskegee, and there I was met with much resentment, but I taught the farmers how to change their crops, how to rotate the crops, and if they planted peanuts and soybeans and sweet potatoes or legumes to bring nitrogen into the land and to change the crop, then they would see a change in their productivity, and they did. And not too soon after we had produced a lot of peanuts, we were met with more opposition from the European farmers who were also growing peanuts, and they were selling it to the United States at a much lower rate. So our farmers were losing a lot of money. We went down to Congress to try to get them to change the laws and the tariffs so that we could make money. But at the same time, I went back into my laboratory and I asked God to give me some direction on what else could we do with these byproducts. What could we do with the peanut? What other products can come from the peanut and the soybean and the sweet potato? And lo and behold, as most of you know, I have been known as the peanut scientist or the peanut man. There were 300 byproducts from the peanut, and there were several other hundred byproducts from the soybean and the sweet potato. We were able to come up with oils and milk and peanut milk, and then we came up with cosmetics, facial cream and cold cream for the ladies. We came up with all of these byproducts, and that is when the farmers realized that there were other things that they could do with those three byproducts. I tell you, it was the greatest thing that has ever happened in my life. And I will always cherish those moments that I was able to make a difference in the lives of others through a gift and from that which God has given us, the Word and His peanuts and the plant that He gives us every day. You can make a difference if you just put your faith and believe in yourself. You can. Thank you for the opportunity to share my life, and if there are any questions, I would be happy to answer them at this time.
Could you explain to our audience boll weevil? What is a boll weevil, and how did that impact the crops there?
Well,
go into that a little bit more.
Well, the boll weevil was a little insect that was actually destroying the cotton during back in my time. It varied. This particular insect actually ate the crops and destroyed the land. Now, once it attacked your plant, it really left devastation. As a matter of fact, there was no recourse from it unless what you did was you had to change the crop. So you would rotate the crop, change the crop, which would and destroy. And of course, we didn't want to use a lot of pesticides, but you would use, and that's how you actually destroyed the boll weevil. Those were one of those concepts that I used in getting the farmers to see how they could revitalize their land.
And you mentioned something about a tariff. Could you enlighten our audience on that?
Yes. Well, what was going on was the American farmers were competing against the European farmers. And the European farmers were selling peanuts to America at a cheaper rate than what the Americans were selling their crops. So the American farmers went down to they went to Congress to try to get Congress to pass a tariff law where there would be a price cut so that we could make money. So that we would survive, the farmers would survive in America. And they had asked me if I would go to Congress and speak to them. Well, Congress had a problem with allowing a African-American to come in and to talk to them about what they should do as far as how things should be done with the laws as well as dealing with this particular tariff. And after spending much time in talking to them, they extended. They wanted to hear more of what I had to say about this particular, what was so important about the tariff, and eventually they passed a law where the American farmers were able to make money off of the products of selling the peanuts and the soybeans and the sweet potatoes.
And was Carver School integrated, or one of the first integrated schools?
Which school was what?
The Mobile
yes,
schools.
Yes, it was one of the first to be integrated, and it was a the amount of those students who actually came were very interested in the studies of that that I had. Which is at Tuskegee. The school itself and the foundation was very popular and it was very successful. All of the money that I was able to generate, I actually put into that foundation and into that school to keep it going. And it was,
I see. That was a traveling school that utilized
the wagon. It was a traveling
wagon.
School, yes. It was a traveling school.
Going from farm to farm.
Yes.
Okay. What about Carver's relationship to the Farmers Co-op?
Well, in the very beginning, it was we had, like I said, I ran into a lot of opposition with the Farmers Co-op. They didn't feel as though that the ideas that I was presenting to them in the beginning were worthwhile. It wasn't until after they saw the change in the crop and the richness of the crop that they see that the changes were that I had suggested them were actually vital to their livelihood. Not only that, but we also showed them that these byproducts, different things that you can make with the byproducts, actually was the selling point, how they could take the peanut and make other things with the peanut and sell that and still make money off of just that one product, which is the peanut. And the same thing with the soybean and the sweet potato. The Farmers Co-op was also one of those organizations that was instrumental in getting me to go speak to the Congress. The Farmers Co-op was, like I said in the beginning, was very difficult, but over time things kind of smoothed out and we were able to become, had an understanding.
And in reference to the rubber plant, was he instrumental in assisting Henry Ford and others in the manufacture of tires?
Yes, there were. Matter of fact, Mr. Ford saw the need in the research that we were doing. And as a matter of fact, he sent money towards our research. And in that research, he realized the need of the product that we were making that would help him in the production of the tires and other byproducts as, that are associated with the Ford Museum that deals with the studies that were presented. Yes.
Wow, very good. I want to thank you, Mr. Carver, for being with us this evening. And sharing this information. Now, Keith Henley.
Yes, sir.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Yeah, we're going to bid him good night. But, Keith, tell us about some of the other shows that you are involved with, historical figures.
Well, I do, like I said, tomorrow I will be Hercules, who is the master chef for General Washington. He was a chef that that was living in Philadelphia when our capital was situated in Philadelphia, right after the American War, the Revolutionary War, rather. Also, I will be portraying. I also portray Henry Box Brown, who was a runaway slave who mailed himself from Richmond, Virginia, to Philadelphia. Fascinating story. His story is just absolutely fascinating.
Excuse me, Keith. Where will you be performing the Master Chef show? Where will that be?
That will be at the Marriott in Philadelphia.
The
Marriott in Philadelphia. I will be performing that for a group of dietitians.
Okay. And what was that second show you was mentioning?
The next show, the next person that I portray is a Henry Box Brown, who was a runaway slave that mailed himself in a box 3 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet from Richmond to Philadelphia. He spent 27 hours in an enclosed box. His story is just absolutely fascinating. It's far different than any other slave story I think anyone has ever heard. He tells the story of what it was like to be a slave from a house slave's point of view. Although Henry and his family were never abused in any way, but their livelihood was different. Although they were still slave and treated as such, his life didn't really take a change until after he gets married. His story is just fascinating. If you ever get a chance, you should read the book. I would highly recommend reading the book. It's called The Narrative of Henry Box Brown, written by himself. It's really
Henry Box Brown, where will you be performing that show?
That's another show that will be performed in February.
In February.
And what city?
And where?
It will be in Camden.
In Camden. Mm-hmm. Now, this Henry Box Brown, did he make a little bit of money off of his story? Tell us a little bit about that, and how did that impact the abolitionist of the day?
Okay, now, could you rephrase the question one more time?
Well, Henry Box Brown, I'm told, made some money off his story. the fact that he spent those, 27 hours in a box and shipped himself to freedom,
right.
And whatnot. And apparently once the story got made, he picked up a few coins about that because of some secret. Are you familiar with that?
I am quite familiar. What happened was once he arrived in Philadelphia, the story did get out of his accomplishment, his ability, that he actually survived. There were several others who attempted to mail themselves in a box but never survived, and he was actually the first. He spent about a week and a half in Philadelphia, and then he was asked to go to the New England, and from there he told his story in New England, and he made some money telling the story. People wanted to hear how he was able to survive. It was about, maybe a few months later, he decided to put his story in writing. And then afterwards, he thought that there were enough people in the Boston area that were interested in the book. But because he was an African-American, they refused to publish the book. And it wasn't until after the passing of the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850, that he felt that it wasn't safe for him to remain where he was. So the money that he had, he used to go to England. And that's where he spent the rest of his days until after the war. And then he comes back to the United States.
So how did he survive 27 hours in a box?
Prayer. He was a praying man, and what he did was he asked the Lord. He said, "Listen, if you help me get through this, if I survive this this ordeal, I promise that I will sing a song in your praise." And he survived. He actually survived. Now he only had like three holes. He had three holes in the box. He had a pouch of water. And that's all he did, and he only used the water just to keep him hydrated, and to just keep him awake. There was, when he arrived in D.C., he was placed on top of his head for 45 minutes. He spent 45 minutes on top of his head. He just prayed that someone would relieve him, and apparently there were two gentlemen who was in a box car with him, and they saw his box. They wanted a place to sit down, so they threw the box down and they sat on him. And at that, he was actually able to survive. Also, in reality, according to the story, the box was supposed to be delivered to the Abolition Society on Fifth and Art.
Yeah,
but
I was wondering if
the
so.
Postal Service. Or they refused to deliver the box. So they left the box on the docks for an additional 2 hours. It wasn't until the gentleman, William Steele, and his company realized that the box had not arrived. So they went to the docks to find the box. And when they found the box, they couldn't get anyone to move the box. So they had to get a cart to get somebody to come and get the box and move it to Fifth and Arch, and that's when they released Mr. Brown from the box.
So did you spend any time in a box to get the feel for what Henry Box Brown went through?
No. I do have a replica of the box, but I pretty much, in order to get a feel of what Henry Box Brown went through, I just rely on various stories that I've been told about slavery, some of my own family stories about slavery and the turmoil and the shame that the things that we have gone through. I use that as a tool to fuel me when I do the story of Henry Box Brown. The ending part of his book is so moving. The last chapter deals with how he and his wife, when the family was sold off, the last thing he was able to do was to see his son. He saw his older son, and the two of them, the only thing he could do was just wave at each other. But the final piece that is just the most moving part of his story is the fact that he was able to see his wife, and he ran to her, and they walked for 4 miles just crying and not saying a word, but they was just crying and walking for 4 miles. And the last word that he said to his wife was, "I'll see you again in heaven." And those words and that whole part of the book, of his story, is just moving. And that's what fuels me, the idea of the separation of husband and wife and the separation of father and son. And
yes.
I know what that feels like because I have not had that bond between my father and we didn't have that bond. And I can just imagine what it would have been like if I was not to be with my mother. So those, I use personal portion of my life in telling his story, which is why it's so compelling to me.
Very good. Now, Mr. Botts' story, that's in William Steele's book. William Steele wrote a book on the Underground Railroad?
That is correct.
Okay.
And Mr. Brown is actually in that.
Okay. And going back to the shift, George Washington, did he run away?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He actually, his story is interesting, too, is because he ran away after the president refused to adhere to the law. A lot of people know that in Philadelphia, right after the war, Philadelphia had a six-month freedom law. And basically, if anyone brought their slave to the city of Philadelphia, and if the slave was there for more than 6 months, then he or she were automatically set free. Well, what the president would do was he would, a couple of days before their six-month time would come up, he would rotate them, send them out of the city, and then bring them right back. So they would have to start their 6 months all over again. As far as Hercules' situation, his son was implicated in a theft and was back to the plantation. Well, the president thought that Hercules was in on the theft and thought that they were going to run away together. So
what was he implicated in? I'm sorry.
He was implicated in the theft. There was some money was stolen.
Oh, money was stolen. And do they know
money
from
was
whom?
Stolen.
Or?
And they thought that his older son was... his oldest son was implicated in it. It wasn't proven that he did it, but it was just implied that he had done it. And he thought that, and the president thought that Hercules was a part of it, and that the two of them were going to run away. So he sent Hercules back to the plantation. But at the same time, not only did he send Hercules back to the plantation, but he demoted him and put him out in the field.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So at that point, that's when I said, "Oh no, you know, I've been in the house all this time, and I've been the master chef. I mean, I am a cook, and then here you are going to put me out in the fields." So on the president's birthday, that's when Hercules ran away. He ran away.
Okay, and he ran away safely. Do we know what happened with him after he ran away?
Now, we don't have any record of him being caught or dying, but we don't know because he ran away. Speculation is that he made it to Philadelphia and the Underground Railroad got him, had him sent somewhere safely. Now, he ran away, he escaped, or as a matter of fact, he ran away right after Oney Judge ran away from Martha Washington in Philadelphia. So Oney Judge ran away, I believe it's 1894 or 84, and then the following year, Hercules runs away. And those are the main slaves as, that really hurt the livelihood of the Washingtons, because Oneida was Martha's number one slave, when they were in Philadelphia, and of course you had Hercules, and for those two to have left the president and the first lady, that was very detrimental. Because even after Oney left, they were they knew where Oney was, and they sent letters trying to get her, but she refused to come back, and they were not able to get her.
Okay, now is there a museum in Philadelphia that chronicles some of this information?
There is the President's House, which is actually on the corner of 6th and Market. It tells you the story of the slaves that lived in the President's House. So they can go there. There's also information at the Atwater Museum, which is on 7th and Chestnut, it's on 7th Street, right between Chestnut and Market. You can find some information on the Oney Judge. And that would be the only two places. Oh, you could probably find some information at the African American Museum, which is actually located on 7th and Arch.
7th and Arch in Philadelphia?
Yes. In Philadelphia, yes.
Now, Hercules wasn't the only slave that escaped from George Washington, is that correct? Did you mention that?
I'm not too sure of the other slaves that actually escaped from the, I'll put it this way, Oney and Hercules were the only two, they were the two famous ones. There were others that attempted, but they didn't make it. As a matter of fact, there's a couple of them actually were sent back to the plantation and died on the plantation.
What other characters are you involved with?
I also do William Steele, and he's the Underground Railroad conductor in Philadelphia. I also do one of the Matthew Henson, who was the first explorer, first black man to make it to the North Pole. And I also do Langston Hughes, the Buffalo Soldiers, and there is a gentleman by the name of Rafael Cordero Molina, who was responsible for educating the island of Puerto Rico. He was an African who sought the need of educating the dark-skinned Africans and Puerto Ricans and Indians in Puerto Rico, because during it was the latter part of the 19th century up until his death, which is the early part of the 20th century, only light-skinned Puerto Ricans who occupied San Juan were allowed to be educated. And Rafael was responsible for educating all boys. He made sure that all of the darker skinned children were able to get an education as well. And he used his money from rolling cigars to educate those children. From his school, there were lawyers, doctors, politicians, writers, educators. He became well known throughout the island. As a matter of fact, his exploits or his story is actually was told in Florida, made it all the way to the United States. So he's a very prominent man. Rafael Cordero, his story is very interesting as well. Very low key, didn't want anything, no books written about him. Matter of fact, it's very hard trying to find any information on him. But his story is very interesting, very, very fascinating. Fascinating.
Speaking
story.
Of that, do you have a writer, or do you do your own writing?
I do my own writing. I do my own writing. Matter of fact, I do a lot of research, and then I just try to make it come alive within my and utilize again my personal exploits and things that happened to me, and then try to put it together and come up with a story. And then again, the story changes depending on the audience that I'm dealing with or that's in front of me.
I see. And do I hear tell you have a PBS film on William Steele's story?
Oh, I didn't know. Sorry, could you repeat that?
A PBS film relative to the William Steele story.
Yes. I heard about it. I actually have a copy of it and didn't get a chance to. I haven't watched it yet. Not only that, but I do have members of my family are Steeles, and I have been talking to several of them to get more information on their famous great-grandfather. So, matter of fact, the Steeles are right in Lawnside in New Jersey, so they have a very prominent family here in New Jersey.
In New Jersey, okay.
Yeah.
Any other characters that we should be talking about?
Ooh, that's enough. and I tried to. No, that's it for right now. Unless someone asked me to. Now, matter of fact, I will be doing William Steele at the first night, which is in Haddonfield on New Year's Eve. At the Masonic Hall, there are three shows. There's a 7 o'clock show, a 8:30 show, and a 10 o'clock show. And if anyone is in the Haddonfield area in New Jersey on New Year's Eve, fascinating concept what they have there. Basically, what they do is they block off that area, and it's a fun time for the family. And they have music, live music, and they have like about 40 different performances going on throughout the night, and it is really a lot of fun.
Keith, I want to congratulate you. You're doing some fascinating work relative to African-American history. Tell us a little something about your other business endeavors. You're quite the entrepreneur.
Yes, I have a catering business, which is called Queenie's Homemade Sweets and Catering, which is actually named after my grandmother. I've utilized a lot of her recipes in my baking. My signature dish would probably be the sweet potato cheesecake. This to die for.
So how do we get in contact with you on that sweet potato cheesecake? That sounds interesting.
you can either call me at 856-952-8407. You can also go to my Facebook page, Queenie's Homemade Sweets and Catering, and place an order. I am located in the Camden area, and my address is 1119 Bergen Avenue in Camden. You can reach me various ways. Oh, you can also order off of my Facebook page, Keith A. Timming, and you can, around the holidays or any other time, you can try to order a sweet potato cheesecake or the peach cobbler. I also make a delicious strawberry rhubarb pie. My way of cooking is, like my grandmother just cooks. No recipes, she just cooks. And I took that concept from her. I got that from her. My mother always tells me that you cook just like your grandmother. That's what your grandmother was. But I make a killer strawberry rhubarb pie, even though rhubarb is only, it's seasonal, but it's to die for.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners that we'll be opening up the phone lines here shortly, and they can call with questions or comments to area code 347-324-5552. Again, that's 347-324-5552. And that'll be at about, in 2 or 3 minutes or so. Now, okay, besides the catering, what else are you into there, Mr. Entrepreneur?
I also have a company called Alpha Designs. It is a crafting. I knit and I sew. So I make blankets and scarves, hats, bags, everything is handmade. That is something I really got into by doing historic interpretation. So I do that, and also I have my own production company where I produce my I'm a playwright as well. So I do a lot of writing, and I try to produce some of my stuff. So it keeps me busy. It keeps me busy. I don't think I'm going to try stepping out and starting another company. I think this is enough to keep me busy.
So how did your parents? You started out in your education in science and biology and transitioned over into acting and entrepreneurship. What did your parents think of that?
Well,
what did they have to say about that change?
Well, typically my mother wasn't very happy about it. I was originally I wanted to be a pediatrician, and the whole concept was I was going to become a pediatrician to raise the money that I needed to fuse the passion, which was theater. So I knew I needed financial backing because I knew it was very difficult to become a full-time actor. So I figured that I would do something that I enjoyed, which was working with children. And I knew that being a pediatrician would give me the money that I needed. The only thing was when I graduated from, when I left South Carolina, I wasn't interested in pursuing medicine. I just wanted to get on stage. I've always been wanting, I just wanted to be on stage even when I was in high school. So I stepped out. And as a matter of fact, the funny thing was the transition actually took place when I came back from South Carolina. I went back to the church, and I was asked to teach the teenage Sunday school class at our church. And I'll never forget our chairman of the Sunday school came to me and said, "Now, Keith, you know we have our Easter cantata every year, and I need you to get these teenagers to participate. They won't participate." And I said, okay, I know why they don't want to participate, but how am I going to get them to participate? So I went to the kids and I told them, I said, listen, you got to do this play, and you know you got to participate. So I know you don't want to do the plays that are written in the book. Why don't you write your own? And the kids looked at me and they were going, yeah, that's a good idea, Mr. Keith. Okay, we'll do that. Of course, I was waiting for teenagers, okay, Lo and behold, you know where that's going. So I ended up writing the script for them. It took me about 20 minutes. I just came up with a concept. They didn't come up. They didn't have no idea. So they gave me a concept of what they wanted. I wrote a script, and we produced it, put it up there, and it was the best thing that they had done. They felt good about themselves. The Sunday school staff and everyone there at the church were like moved. They were like, oh, my God, how did you get them to do that? And I was like, wow, yeah, how did I get them to do that? And at that, you know, and at that moment, that's when the light bulb went off. Okay, this is your calling. And
okay. When are you gonna take this show to Broadway? Take that talent to Broadway.
You know, I'm working on it. Trust me, I'm working on it. I have there's an off Broadway show that I've done for the last 3 years. It's called This Is Why I Whisper, written by a talented writer, playwright, Sybil Renee. Fascinating, and that show is moving. It's a lot of work, but we're getting there. We're getting there. It's getting there. I think if anything, that's the show that's going to probably get me to where I need to go on Broadway. So we're looking forward to that.
So, well, repeat that title again so that when it hits Broadway, we'll know
it. It's called This Is Why I Whisper.
Expound a little bit on that show.
Well,
This Is Why I Whisper.
It is about a family, an African-American family, who deals with mental illness. There are four siblings, three girls and the brother. The brother suffers from schizophrenia, and the three sisters are trying to decide what they're going to do with the brother. The uncle, who the character that I play, is the patriarch of the family, and he's the one that is keeping them in line. And it really, it has its moments of laughter and seriousness, but it really tells the true story about how this family deals with this particular mental illness that plagues our society, and a lot of people really don't know the ramifications of what schizophrenia actually, how it affects members of the family. It is really a fact. It's a wonderful story. If you're in the New York area, I highly recommend keep your eyes out for This Is Why I Whisper. You can also go to our Facebook page. There's a Facebook page called This Is Why I Whisper. The writer, again, is Sybil Renee. There's a show that should be coming up real soon in the New York area, and she is considering bringing it to Philadelphia. Hopefully before the end of the year it's out. But please, this is a must-see. I would highly recommend it. It is an excellent piece of work. Excellent.
Okay, the lines are open. If anyone out there has anything to say or want to ask a question or comments, now's the time. Area code 347-324-5552. Keith, while we're waiting to see if anyone gives us a call, could you recap just briefly the list of characters that you play and also the contact information again for your businesses?
Okay. Some of the personas that I portray is Hercules, who is the master chef for General Washington.
Excuse me, Keith. Do we have a caller on the line?
Hello.
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 Go ahead, caller. Hello, caller. Are you there?
Hi. Yes. Hi. How are you doing?
Okay. What's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Tanya Tims Taylor, and I'm calling from Cokesville, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I would like to say I really enjoyed this interview. And, Keith, I find you fascinating. Here's my quick question, because I know we're getting ready to go off the air. All right. I am an educator. And when I tell the story of Frederick Douglass, I actually do not tell the fact that he's a slave. And I'll tell you why, just very quickly. I don't tell he's a slave until after I give his situation, his context. I say, oh, you know, he grew up, you know, in a world full of violence. He didn't know his parents. He went on, and, you know, he became this great person. And I'm asking you, with STEM and with STEAM, you know, STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math, and STEM is science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. How do you relate someone like a George Washington Carver to students of today or audiences of today to help them? Because sometimes when they hear that word slave, they say, oops, ancient, long time ago, and so it sort of disconnects them. So how do you relate these characters to people who are younger?
That's a very good question. Believe it or not, even the older ones have a problem with that word, that S word. It's amazing how in our society we have omitted truth. And for us to denounce that we were slaves or that our ancestors were slaves, it's heartbreaking. And the best way I make sure that the story that I tell is very – I make myself it's exciting. I turn the story to make it exciting so that the child or whoever is listening to the story buys into the story. And then eventually I will mention the fact that he or this particular person was a slave. And then I go in, as you do, tell the important aspects of what this person has done. And then there are some parts where you can actually feed off of the emotion of the person by bringing telling the emotional story of the of that particular person. And when you do that, you captivate them. And the minute you captivate them, then you got them. And once you get them, then you can really flood them with the story. And then they go like, wow. Oh, I normally don't come straight out and tell them that he's a slave. But eventually, by the time the story ends, they forget that he was a slave. And then they go into like, wow. So how did he go about doing, so how did he do this and how did he do that? But you have to, eventually, you do have to tell them that they are slaves. And then they'll buy into it. But, yeah, that's a good question.
Can I get in here, Keith? Can I get in here for a minute? Excellent question. I would suggest, too, that we insert the phrase freedom seekers, rather than the term slavery.
That's good.
And we remind our young folks and our ancestors and all those songs and stories that comes down, that have come down. I'm thinking of How We Got Over. I hear Mahalia Jackson singing that right now. You infuse that kind of language and that kind of imagery into that story to these young kids, and maybe play Mahalia for them, et cetera. And I'll step back now, Mr. Henley, and let you go ahead.
I have one little quick question. So
yes, ma'am.
Sure. One more question. Dealing with this science, right? How is it, or why do you believe that someone as great as George Washington Carver, you know, he gets accolades if you watch a lot of the things on soybeans and, you know, a lot alternative electricity. Why is it, do you think, that he's not known in our community? I'm not putting that onus on outside of our community, but where's the disconnect between the scientists in our community and the narrative that we tell?
Personally, I would say that it is, and I don't want to say that it's at the fault of our community, but if we don't tell our story to our children, then our children won't know our story. And just as it's unfortunate that we only, in some cases, only tell our story during Black History Month. And all of a sudden, during Black History Month, our story is prominent. Everybody wants to tell the story then. But then after that, they forget our story. We forget to tell our story. And I think that the reason why people like Mr. Carver and Mr. Douglas and Mr. Brown, the Browns, and even Hercules, those stories are not told because a lot of us don't know the stories, and those of us who do know the stories, we're not telling those stories regularly. Even in our own family, even if you just look at your family, your own family tree, how many of us actually sit down with our grandparents and our grandparents tell the story of how we survived? You know, what do you know about your personal story, about your own family? We don't talk about it, and we don't ask our grandparents, we don't ask the elders of our family, you know, Grandma, tell me about how, you know, were we slaves, were we on a plantation, or how did we get to where we are? I mean, we're not inquisitive about our own story. So for us to try to share the stories of those African-Americans who have actually paved the way for us to be where we are now, we're not telling that story. And I think as educators, we should tell that story. And even parents need to tell the story, tell our story. And we need to really get with those who are the elders in our families or in our neighborhood, ask them questions about who we are, where we came from, so that we have an idea of where we're going. I would use the president as a prime example. Every time he gets up and speaks, he always, if you ever notice, he always talks about his grandmother, his mother, and his story. He always keeps his story in front of you so you know where he came from. We need to do that as well.
Well, thank you.
In reference to the caller's comment about the STEM, S-T-E-M, can you infuse or incorporate some of that STEM requirement into your play, Keith?
Oh, I could. Now, could you give me the acronym? What does the STEM stand for again?
Science, technology, engineering, and math. They have STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math, and they have STEAM, which is science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, because what they found is that people who are good in math also have a tendency to be artistic, so it goes from STEM or STEAM. And to add on to what the questioner was just asked, how do you incorporate the entrepreneur, since you're an entrepreneur, how do you incorporate the entrepreneur element of Booker T. Washington? Because Washington actually was able to help. He was also much like, you know, he helped George Washington Carver in his developments and his different pieces. So you're an entrepreneur. So how do you also, in telling the story of George Washington Carver, tell the story of the STEM story, science, technology, engineering, and math, but then also the entrepreneur story, because all of that is all into, you know, your narrative of George Washington Carver. How do you do it, or how do you do it, if you do?
Well, that is, believe it or not, that's easy. That's really easy, because basically what you do is you take the elements of each one of those components, and what you do is you find where the particular character person that you're talking about, such as Dr. Carver, okay, you would utilize, okay, how did he use technology? How would he have used, or what form of technology of his time did he use in his experiments, as well as mathematics? You would tie in all of those components of the acronym into his story, and you would show how that was relevant in his time, and how is it relevant in your time as well. And then you, after you get the kids, the children, to see that from his standpoint, then what he could do as in his presentation, or what I would do in my presentation, is I would get them to give me an example on how can they infuse what they have learned to something of that will make it relevant for them in their time. You know, you could do like a time period, like, okay, in my time, these are the components that I used in mathematics and technology and so forth and so on. Now, you tell me, how could you use those same components in your time to make it relevant for you? And then you pull that all together, which makes it even more exciting for the children, because now they're part of the actual production. And again, the stories change depending on the situation. So if I was with a group of children, if I was at your school, that's how I would present it. I wouldn't just do a 90-minute or a 45-minute show on George Washington Carver. I would do something that would incorporate them to be a part of the production so that they can see importance. And then they get up, then they buy into who George Washington Carver is, or who Booker T. Washington was, or Hercules. Even the story of Hercules, I could even implement that in your program as well, because he still used those acronyms to do what he had to do. They're there. You just got to find that, and then once you get it in there, and the kids and they see it, they're like, oh yeah, I see where you're coming from, because cooking is. Cooking is a science. That's the science within itself. You got to know how long you got to show them how to cook on coal as opposed to an oven. Oh, so how do you know what the temperature is in the stove of that magnitude versus electric oven or a gas oven that we have today? So you play with that. That's how you get them.
Okay.
Keith, with your background in science and your artistic ability, it would seem to me that you would be in a great demand in some of these schools around the country. And it sounds like the caller is right on target in terms of this STEM. That's a federal law, I believe, isn't it? As caller still there?
Yeah, they're basically having those emphasis. Yeah, they're most definitely they're focusing and they're pushing it like crazy because for the most part what we're doing is that it's going to make us a competitive piece. I always like to say STEM plus B or STEM or STEAM plus B or STEM plus B, meaning that business component. That's why that entrepreneurship, you can have the best product in the world, as you know, because we have some of the products that George Washington Carver created, we haven't even broken to an assembly line with. I mean,
no,
just
no,
the wonder
not at
that
all.
We haven't even touched that, you know, we haven't even touched the stuff that he had. I loved his philosophy that nothing in this world needs to go to waste, you know, so it's like, and that's what, you know, this whole emphasis, I think that for us, as well, let me just say, for those in the African-American community, STEM could be, you know, take us leaps and bounds, just like it have done in what they call the BRIC nations. When you look at India, when you look at China, you know, what you're looking at is that because of their emphasis in those areas, they've taken, you know, rural poverty and transformed it. You know, and so
mm-hmm.
once you put that entrepreneurial element to it, you know, you're having, you know, Hong Kong is making, you know, millionaires every day. I mean, what
right.
happens is that it can serve as an ecosystem for a Silicon Valley, and it can actually happen, you know, in an area like Camden or in Newark or in, you know, in Harlem or, well,
mm-hmm.
while Harlem is still Harlem, or in south side of Chicago, or down south where I live, you know. It can be an embryo if you basically, you know, that's what I'm saying. Sometimes with us as a community, we like to see, have and feed up on those communal narratives, and we get more from a testimony, as they call it in the church, we get more from these testimonies than any type of scientific guide could we have. But once you start to see that it can be done, it's almost like, okay, a path. In one of the interviews, this young woman, she had two restaurants in Harlem. This is a previous interview on the radio. They had two restaurants in Harlem, and basically she was talking about how the first brother served as a bell cow. And oftentimes what I'm saying is that it seems like the story of George Washington Carver, when combined with Booker T. Washington, can serve as a bell cow for you know, going into some of these sins and having us feel comfortable in them, you know, because that's not something that's normally cultivated in our community. In our community, our entertainment, because that's what we were chattel and entertainment for a larger community, and unfortunately, that's where the emphasis stills on.
Right.
So that's
what part of the country are you again? Are you
I'm in Pennsylvania now, but I'm originally from Gulfport, Mississippi, which is about 60
okay.
miles east of New Orleans.
Well,
mm-hmm.
Keith, it sounds like you're going to be making a field trip to Pennsylvania.
Well, listen, I'm not too far from, I'm in Camden, New Jersey, so I'm not too far from her. And
not too
now,
far
what,
away,
Pennsylvania,
yes.
Where are you from?
I'm sorry?
What part of Pennsylvania are you in?
Oh, I'm in Cokesville, so I'm from you. I'm about 60 miles out. So, yeah,
right.
we're going to have, and I teach at Westchester University. I'm going to basically try to, and I started the African American Studies program there. We have a minor. And so that's why I most definitely try to get you in. But I just want to see us do the science or the STEM with a B. You know, I want that. So if if we can bring you in and we can have this, you know, this sharing. I also serve on the coast. I serve on the school district where I'm at now. And so what happens is that just to see this narrative, but I've been, you know, excited to see what this narrative is, you know, like this narrative. Like,
right.
How do you ignite that mind? I love the story of Ben Carson when he said he looked in the microscope and his mind was fixated at that moment. It ignited. And I think that a story like a Booker T. Washington plus a story with Booker T. Washington plus Carter G. Woodson, plus George Washington Carver, those stories ignite. You know, pretty much like when you talked about Henry Box Brown, right?
Right.
I mean, that story ignited. Or you take the Blotson collection, reading through William Steele and seeing his family, that ignited a whole collection, you know, at Temple or,
right.
you know, at most definite. So, you know, what I'm saying is that you got this thing going, and I just want to see that ignite.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Oh, great. Caller.
Say something. It will ignite. It will ignite. Yeah. That is true. That is true.
Well, thank you all so much. And I look forward to listening. All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Keith, again, we're about out of time here.
Okay.
For tonight's broadcast, but would you give your contact information one more time?
Yes. I can be Facebook, Keith A. Tinley, or you can call me at 856-952-8407. And my address is, 1119 Bergen Avenue in Camden, New Jersey. But you call me at my cell phone, which is always by my side, and I can be reached there. And again, that number is 856-952-8407. And I truly want to thank you for allowing me this opportunity to be on your show. It has been rewarding and quite exciting, and I appreciate
it. The privilege is all ours, Keith. Again, I want to congratulate you on the work that you're doing, spreading this history, getting that information out, and hopefully getting it out to the younger folk out there, and hopefully you can contact the caller there in Pennsylvania and really get something started. I think you're really on to something, and we appreciate your coming on tonight and sharing your information on the gifts of freedom.
Well, thank you very much, sir. It's been an honor as well.
Thank you. Good night.
You're welcome. Good night.
Okay. Bye-bye. Well, there you have it, folks. Just wound up another fascinating show of Black history here on the Gist of Freedom, brought to you by author and historian Leslie Gist. We'll be back again on Tuesday with another exciting show for you. Take care, folks. Good night.